A dramatic jump in COVID-19 cases. I'm Pam Puso, Fox News. More than 77,000 new coronavirus infections were recorded in the U.S. yesterday. That more than doubles Thursday's total, according to Johns Hopkins.
There is a clear message that is coming through. This is becoming a pandemic of the unvaccinated. We are seeing outbreaks of cases in parts of the country that have low vaccination coverage.
CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky, hospitalizations and deaths are also up among the unvaccinated. Officials say more than 90 million Americans who are eligible for shots have yet to get them. To combat the surge of COVID cases, indoor mask mandates are coming back in Los Angeles County, California, just before midnight tonight. They're recommended in other parts of the state.
Officials in counties including Contra Costa, Marin, San Francisco, Santa Clara, and Sonoma are strongly urging people to wear masks indoors again in public places to, quote, ensure easy verification that all unvaccinated people are masked.
Fox's Jessica Rosenthal. No arrests in the nation's capital, where police say a six-year-old girl was shot and killed late last night. Five other people were hurt. A pathway to citizenship appears more uncertain for hundreds of thousands of young immigrants in the U.S.
A federal judge in Texas ruling that a program that protects immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as children from being deported violated the law when it was created. But the judge says the hundreds of thousands of current so-called Dreamers would not be affected until further court rulings. The judge sided with a group of states suing to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Program, or DACA, arguing it was illegally created by then-President Obama in 2012.
Fox's Sean Langell, an appeal is expected. America's listening to Fox News. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is expected to come face-to-face today with investigators looking into allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct.
These allegations, mostly from former and current aides to the governor, range from bullying to inappropriate sexual comments and touching, like kissing without consent and groping. The AG's office is expected to release a report of its findings by the end of the summer.
Fox's Brian Yenes. The probe is being conducted by the state attorney general's office. The governor's accusers have given sworn depositions. Governor Cuomo has denied any wrongdoing. Law enforcement officials in New York City believe lives were saved by a massive drug bust. Last month, 40 pounds of heroin and fentanyl were seized and three suspected drug traffickers were arrested. Officials say the drugs were branded with the names COVID-19 and Drop Dead and had a street value of $5 million. One official says 75% of all drug overdoses in New York City are linked to fentanyl. It's been out of commission for a month now, but NASA is hopeful the Hubble telescope will soon resume scientific research.
The Hubble Space Telescope is back in business, NASA is hoping, after the latest repair mission handled remotely by flight controllers in Maryland. They've switched a command and data unit installed on a spacewalk over a decade ago to backup equipment on Thursday, and it appears to have worked, kicking a payload computer into action. The payload computer stopped working last month, suspending the collection of scientific data. After more than 30 years in space and well over a million observations, NASA plans to launch Hubble's successor later this year. But for now, they plan to resume Hubble's operations once they finish monitoring and calibrating to ensure the hardware is working properly.
Fox's Lisa Brady. I'm Pam Puso, Fox News.
In Virginia, the earlier accident on 95 southbound at Oak Pits Boulevard in Dale City now moved to the right shoulder. You will still find some brief delays. No other problems to report on 95 in Manassas. Watch out for construction southbound of the Prince William Parkway south of 66 with two lanes blocked. And they should be picking up the work zone that had the ramp from eastbound 50 to eastbound 66 closed in Fairfax. So far, no delays on the Capitol Beltway throughout Maryland and Virginia. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WML Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Stormwatch 7 is on weather alert today. We have a heat advisory, DC and points east through the afternoon. High temperatures into the mid-90s, but it will feel like closer to 105 degrees, mainly east of DC through the afternoon. Now, a cold front also shifting through. Flash flood watch in effect for the D.C. Metro through late tonight. We'll have the chance for some heavy storms this afternoon and into the evening. Heavy rainfall, also some isolated wind damage can't be ruled out. Later on tonight, temperatures will be back in the 60s in the suburbs. Low 70s around town. Storms will come to an end for your Sunday. Partly sunny. High temperatures below 90 degrees. Finally back into the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton off this morning, and obviously plenty to cover, including a deposition taking place today in the state of New York. The governor, Andrew Cuomo, who of course has had allegations of sexual harassment lodged against him, he will be in a deposition for the better part of the day. We'll go into detail with that a little bit later on with Jim Trusty, our legal counsel. Also, when we're talking with Jim this morning, we'll be speaking with Jim about the troubling report from the Department of Justice watchdog slamming the FBI investigation into Larry Nassar. Of course, he was the prominent gymnastics doctor. He's been sentenced to prison for over 100 years after being accused of sexual assault by more than 100 women and girls. Well, there was some problems with the special agent in charge in Indianapolis. The DOJ watchdog report is out, and we'll get into the details of that with Jim Trusty coming up a bit later on this morning. Also on the way, we're going to talk with Gordon Chang. The topic this morning will be China and the very latest on the COVID investigations, the lack of cooperation of the Chinese with the World Health Organization. They've said, you've already had three investigations, you're not doing any more. Well, those investigations were not exactly thorough. Big question marks as to what's next with China and the investigation into the origins of COVID. Oh, by the way, the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, skipped the APEC conference, the Asia-Pacific Economic Council event. President Biden participated virtually, but the Chinese president sent a video instead. So a snub to APEC from China this year. We're going to talk with Jennifer Harper this morning. Of course, she writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, and an interesting twist to things when it comes to polls. You know, you'd think the media polls and how people feel about the media would at some point just reach the bottom. But no, they've gone even lower this time around. And it'll be a very interesting conversation with Jennifer Harper on that one when we get to it. Also, what's going on with the media and the journalists joining unions? It's kind of an interesting twist because it's a record number of journalists heading into unions. You've been hearing about the voter ID question and what's been going on in Texas. Well, a new poll will solve the voter ID argument forever. And we're going to be talking with Jennifer Harper about that this morning, as well as inflation. So lots to cover with Jen today. And we'll be catching up with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer later on this morning. And with Tony, we want to get into some of the things happening on the ground in Afghanistan and in Cuba, the conditions that we see now, the conditions that we can expect when the changes come in Afghanistan. Of course, the Taliban taking over more ground every week. And the question is, what will happen to the women in Afghanistan? As to Cuba, what will happen next if the protests are ultimately quashed by the Cuban government? What happens to those protesters? What happens to, I won't even say free speech in Cuba because there is none, so I'd say what happens with speech moving forward in Cuba? And also, you may have seen the back and forth between former President Trump and the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mark Milley. Well, we'll talk about that with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer also this morning. KT McFarland will be joining us a little bit later on. We'll get her latest take on what's going on with Cuba and how that affects foreign policy for America. So that's all on the way on the Saturday Morning Update. Now, we're going to be getting into quite a few things here in the next few minutes, including inflation and how that impacts all of us and what those numbers are showing. It's not pretty. We'll talk about it next. But first, we're going to head over to the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
In Virginia, the earlier accident on 95 southbound at Oak Ridge Boulevard in Dale City now cleared, and it looks like the delays have pretty much eased down. On the outer loop at Braddock Road, a minor accident reported, but looks like that has now been cleared to the shoulder. You will find some road work in the district inbound on the Suitland Parkway at the Anacostia Freeway. Right lane gets by there. I'm getting reports of an accident right now in Maryland on Route 1 northbound at Gatewood Drive. Use caution there. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Stormwatch 7 is on weather alert today. We have a heat advisory, D.C. and points east through the afternoon. High temperatures into the mid-90s, but it will feel like closer to 105 degrees, mainly east of D.C. through the afternoon. Now, a cold front also shifting through. Flash flood watch in effect for the D.C. metro through late tonight. We'll have the chance for some heavy storms this afternoon and into the evening. Heavy rainfall, also some isolated wind damage can't be ruled out. Later on tonight, temperatures will be back in the 60s in the suburbs, low 70s around town. Storms will come to an end for your Sunday. Partly sunny, high temperatures below 90 degrees, finally back into the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Currently in the nation's capital, 77 degrees. We're 6:16 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. Inflation numbers, not good, and I'm sure you're finding out, especially if you've filled up with a tank of gas recently. I want to quote a CNN business story. Prices keep rising in the United States, putting a squeeze on American consumers' wallets. The trend got worse in June. The Consumer Price Index, the nation's key inflation measure, jumped 0.9% in June, the largest one-month increase in 13 years. Over the last 12 months, prices were up 5.4%, the biggest jump in annual inflation in nearly 13 years. So what has the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, got to say about it?
We're experiencing a big uptick in inflation, bigger than many expected, bigger than certainly than I expected. And we're trying to understand whether it's something that will pass through fairly quickly or whether we need to act.
He wasn't expecting it. If anybody in the country should be on top of this, wouldn't you think the chairman of the Fed would maybe have had some indication that it was happening? How about Janet Yellen, Secretary of the Treasury?
We will have several more months of rapid inflation, so I'm not saying that this is a one-month phenomenon, but I think over the medium term, we'll see inflation decline back toward normal levels.
I'm not sure how they see that. If they couldn't see it coming, how do they see it going away already? But I guess what else, you know, do you say? What else spin do you put on it when you're the Secretary of Treasury or the Chairman of the Fed at this point in time? So not a good situation there. Now, how about those Texas Democrats, the House Democrats, who took off and left their positions in the House instead of voting on a bill they know that they would lose? And, of course, that is the Texas voting legislation that provides more early voting than the state of Delaware provides and the state of New York. But why should we let that fact get in the middle of the debate? Because it would certainly ruin the field trip that these Texas House Democrats are on. Now, I've got Vice President Harris here praising these House Democrats and equating them to a number of protests in the past and the brave protesters in the past. As you listen to this, I want you to think of the people on the Edmund Pettus Bridge or some of the civil rights demonstrators back in the 60s who were clubbed by police officers in certain instances when violence erupted. How the vice president can equate their fight and their struggle to a group of Texas legislators flying to the nation's capital on a private jet catered with Miller Lite beer. I don't think there's a fair comparison, but the vice president made it.
I had an extensive meeting yesterday with, I think, some of the most courageous elected leaders that we could know at this moment. I said it yesterday, and I'll say it again. They took bold, courageous action. In line with the legacy of everyone from Frederick Douglass, who's over my right shoulder, when he fought for the right of black men to vote in America, to the legacy that includes all those women who marched down Pennsylvania Avenue for women's right to vote, to all of those folks who shed their blood on the Edmund Pettus Bridge to make sure that we would, in 1965, pass the Voting Rights Act.
I still don't quite get the equivalency there. Interestingly enough, a Texas House Speaker has arranged, he's a Republican, he has arranged for a private jet to bring them back. The plane will be on standby at Dulles International Airport. Says his team, his political campaign, not taxpayers, will pay for the flight back, but he can't force the Democrats to get on the plane. I hope the voters in Texas speak up when the elections come in the next cycle in 2022, because that certainly is a mess in Texas. It is 6:21. It is the Saturday Morning Update. A lot more to cover. Quick break, and we're back. It is the Saturday Morning Update. We're at 6:23. I would say the protesters in Cuba in the past week or so have shown a lot more at stake and a lot more at risk than a group of House Democrats flying around on private jets. And what is going on in Cuba is important. The question mark is, where will it go? Will there actually be change in Cuba, or will the government ultimately quash all of the protests and ultimately the protesters? A lot of questions around Washington as why the Biden administration has been so inactive and really not made any strides in support, with the exception of a positioning statement late in the week. But Peter Doocy asked the press secretary at the White House, Jen Psaki, about it a little bit earlier in the week. And listen to how she characterizes the Cuban government.
Do you think that people are leaving Cuba because they don't like communism?
I think we've been pretty clear that we think people are leaving Cuba, or not leaving Cuba, or protesting in the streets all as well, because they are opposed to the oppression, to the mismanagement of the government in the country. And we certainly support their right to protest. We support their efforts to speak out against their treatment in Cuba.
Mismanagement. Okay. Now, here's an interesting twist. We've seen the southern border between the United States and Mexico basically wide open, and not much being done by the administration to control things down there. The Customs and Border Patrol and the Texas authorities and state authorities in Arizona doing their best, but very little effort on the federal government's part to cut down on the amount of illegal immigration at this point on the southern border. So it's fine there, but keep in mind, in South Florida, it's a different political mix. In South Florida, the Cuban immigrants who have come to the United States are traditionally Republican. So you would think that if there are going to be migrants from Cuba, ultimately they may end up as Republican voters. If they are able to get out of Cuba now, they come to this country, they're influenced by their family members here, they're probably influenced by the strong stance that Florida Republicans have taken about the communist government in Cuba for decades, they probably lean Republican and will become Republicans. So, of course, our Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, does not want to let any Cubans into Florida. I mean, perish the thought they'd become Republican voters. Here's what he said.
Allow me to be clear. If you take to the sea, you will not come to the United States. Any migrant intercepted at sea, regardless of their nationality, will not be permitted to enter the United States.
So that is our Secretary of Homeland Security. So if you're brave enough to take a boat out of Cuba and sneak out of Cuba, if you're brave enough to do it, we don't want you in Florida. Certainly don't want any more Republican voters in Florida. It is 6:27. You're listening to the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
In the news at 6:30, forecasters say the dry, unstable, and windy conditions will keep fueling a massive wildfire in southern Oregon. The largely uncontained blaze grows by miles each day. It's known as the Bootleg Fire, just one of numerous wildfires that are burning across the U.S. West. Crews had to flee the fire lines of the Oregon blaze late Thursday after a dangerous fire cloud started to collapse. It threatened them with strong downdrafts and flying embers. Less than a week after that rare series of anti-government protests were met by police and government sympathizers and even elicited self-criticism from the president of Cuba, Miguel Díaz-Canel, things do appear calm in Cuba this morning. The question is, for how much longer? Squares and parks were taken over by government sympathizers with flags on Friday. The circulation of traffic and people was normalizing again, but mobile internet data service, which authorities cut last Sunday, remains limited in Cuba. A federal judge in Texas on Friday ordered the end to an Obama-era program that protects DACA. Now, advocates are calling on Congress and President Biden to act quickly on legislation that would provide a path to citizenship to hundreds of thousands of young immigrants after that judge's ruling in Texas. The ruling yesterday keeps the program in place for existing recipients, but bars the government from approving any new applications. The U.S. District Judge Andrew Hanen, ruling in favor of Texas and eight other states that had sued to halt the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA, which provides limited protections to about 650,000 people. 6:32, time for a check of the traffic and weather, and Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
The Beltway in Annandale on the outer loop at the Little River Turnpike, an incident cleared away. Just watch out for a brief delay there. No problems now to report on 95 from Springfield to Dale City. Earlier accident southbound at Dale Boulevard cleared away. You will find construction right now in the district. Inbound on the Sunland Parkway at the Anacostia Freeway. Right lane gets by that work zone. Watch out for brief delays. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Stormwatch 7 is on weather alert today. We have a heat advisory, DC and points east through the afternoon. High temperatures into the mid-90s, but it will feel like closer to 105 degrees, mainly east of DC through the afternoon. Now, a cold front also shifting through. Flash flood watch in effect for the D.C. Metro through late tonight. We'll have the chance for some heavy storms this afternoon and into the evening. Heavy rainfall, also some isolated wind damage can't be ruled out. Later on tonight, temperatures will be back in the 60s in the suburbs. Low 70s around town. Storms will come to an end for your Sunday. Partly sunny. High temperatures below 90 degrees. Finally back into the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Currently 77 degrees in the nation's capital. 6:33 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
Happy to be back on WMAL. Join me, Dan Bongino, weekdays, noon to 3, on 105.9 FM, WMAL.
It's the Saturday morning update. Glad you've joined us. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper is with us each week. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
You always keep tabs on polls, and you watch how people are feeling about the news media. What's the latest?
Well, this is we often hear a lot of surveys which really dump all over the media, and that goes on and on. But this is one of the first polls I've ever seen that gets on the cultural side of the media and how the media is being perceived by the public. And, you know, this whole phenomenon of a hostile news media is really nothing new. In fact, I looked up when the first account of a hostile media was. It goes all the way back to George Washington. This is according to a historical account from the Fred W. Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington at Mount Vernon, of course. And they say that the nation's first president was started out with glorified coverage from the early press, but by the end of Washington's first term, hostile newspaper writers had attacked both his domestic and foreign policies, and things kind of went downhill from there. And so let's come back to a poll that came out this week and why I paid attention to it. And here is what they found. This is right from the pollster. I didn't make up these words. 6 out of 10 U.S. voters now view the media as, quote, truly the enemy of the people, unquote.
6 out of 10?
6 out of 10, Rick. And this is according to Rasmussen Report's voter survey. And those damning words, the enemy of the people, are coming from the pollster itself, by the way, just thinking I didn't make it up myself. So anyway, the findings could very well imply that a majority of voters agree with former President Donald Trump that the press does not have America's best interest at heart. And here are the actual numbers. The pollster found that 58% of likely U.S. voters agree that the media are truly the enemy of the people. This includes 34% who strongly agree, and another third of them don't agree with the idea. But again, this is a kind of a unique poll. It was 1,000 likely U.S. voters conducted July 7th through 8th. And that's your media hit today.
You've got a poll on something I don't recall we having seen a poll on in your column, the voter ID question.
Yeah, this is, let's stick on the polls just for a while this early in the morning, but that's okay. If you're wondering about the whole public opinion on whether or not people should be required to show a decent identification when they go to vote, well, this solves the whole issue. And I cite the source of this poll. This is coming from National Public Radio, PBS NewsHour, and the Marist College poll. Here's what they found. 79% of U.S. adults think voters should be required to show a government-issued photo ID whenever they vote. That includes 94% of Republicans, 83% of independents, and even 57% of Democrats agree with that. And one other part of this poll, 81% of non-whites and 78% of whites also agree. Non-whites and whites are the language of the pollster itself. And only 19% overall say voters should not be required to show an ID. And this is coming from National Public Radio, PBS NewsHour, and Amherst College. It's a poll of 1,115 U.S. adults conducted June 22nd through 29 and released July 2nd. So when people argue about that, they need to look at this poll.
You've got some interesting numbers on journalists and an organization they're joining.
I hadn't seen this lately, but apparently journalists are now joining unions in record numbers. Perhaps there is safety in numbers. I don't know. But journalists in multiple fields are banding together in unprecedented numbers. And this is according to the Poynter Institute. That is a Florida-based nonprofit which tracks all the journalism trends and ethical practices and so forth. And here's what they say. Not just a wave, but a movement. Journalists unionize at record numbers. Union leaders at newspapers, digital outlets, and broadcast stations are seeing historic levels of organizing that show little signs of stopping. Again, this is coming from the Poynter Institute. In the past decade, workers at news publications have launched more than 200 union drives, and over 90% of them have been successful. And this is according to the Poynter Institute analysis. And they say there were 37 union drives where journalists asked formally for union representation in 2020 alone, all of them successful, and their data is coming from the National Labor Relations Board, the Writers Guild of America, and Cultural Workers Organize, a research project which tracks financial insecurity in the field. I don't know whether this is going to affect news coverage, but it's just something to watch, just a business phenomenon out there.
We talk a lot about poll numbers with you, Jennifer, but how about some numbers we can all feel when we go to the grocery store or go to the gas station?
Well, there's actually a handy new term for this phenomenon if you're feeling the pinch whenever you go out to buy anything, and it is called Biden inflation. This is according to the Republican National Committee, because they've done a lot of research, of course, on what kind of inflation we're talking about. And, of course, a lot of people may know that this week, overall consumer prices rose 5.4% in June from the previous years, and this is the highest 12-month rate since August 2008, and that's according to the Labor Department this week. And here's a couple of some of the damning figures from the GOP source, from the Republican National Committee, because they are closely tracking this for all the obvious reasons. They say home prices are up by 15%, rental costs have tripled. That came from Fannie Mae. Airfares are rising at the rate of 10% a week. Hotel rooms are up by 36%. That came from CBS. The cost of eating out has risen by 4.1%. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. 48% of small businesses have been forced to raise their prices, the highest percentage in four decades. That came from CNBC. And the price of used cars and trucks has risen by 45.2%. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And according to the GOP research, economists warn trillions in new spending is a recipe for even more inflation and higher prices as American workers and business struggle to recover and as families face rising prices. Now is not the time for Biden's $3 trillion tax hike and $6 trillion in government spending spree. So, again, Republican National Committee is monitoring all these numbers for us.
Well, the Biden administration's been complaining about misinformation when it comes to vaccines and vaccinations. Jennifer, you have some information for us.
Yes, I do. This is coming from the Kaiser Family Foundation. They asked people, about 630 U.S. adults, how they felt after they actually got the shot. And to my knowledge, nobody really has pondered this, but here's what they found. You can compare how you felt when you got your shot or didn't get your shot as the days go by. Anyway, 24% of the adults who received the COVID-19 vaccine said they now feel safe. 22% said they experienced relief. 10% felt no different or just felt neutral about the whole thing. 9% had an overall positive feeling. 6% feel great or good. 5% feel a sense of freedom. And 5% no longer worry about getting COVID or dying from it. Again, this is from, 3% feel more confident now. Kind of mixed feelings about the whole thing. I don't know whether this reflects on their personal experience or the media coverage of it, but it's coming from the Kaiser Family Foundation poll, and it was released on Tuesday.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, and you can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Thank you very much. 6:43 Saturday morning updates, WMAL. We'll talk with Jim Trusty next. The Andrew Cuomo deposition coming up today. We'll get into that momentarily. But first off, let's head to the WMAL Traffic Center, and Michelle Murray's there this morning.
In Maryland and Jessup, watch out for an accident on Route 1 southbound at Gatewood Drive. The right lane is blocked, so stay to your left and use caution there. Elsewhere, watch out for an incident right now on the outer loop of the Beltway, the Little River Turnpike, but that has been cleared to the shoulder, just a brief delay there. So far, if you're traveling on 95, 395, no delays or incidents reported from Dale City all the way in towards Springfield, and 395 looks clear from Edsel Road to the 14th Street Bridge. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
This will be the last day of the heat wave. High temperatures into the mid-90s. A heat advisory is in effect noon through 8 o'clock this evening, D.C. and points east. Also, a cold front will shift through during the afternoon. A flash flood watch is in effect for the D.C. and Baltimore metros through the overnight hours. Could have some very heavy rainfall thinking through the afternoon and evening. Some storms may be on the strong to severe side with damaging winds as well. Storms will come to an end overnight for your Sunday. Partly sunny skies. Temperatures a little bit cooler back in the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
77 degrees at 6:44 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It's a Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty joins us every week. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. He is the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks. Good morning, Rick.
We are familiar with the just horrible story about USA Gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar. Nassar is serving over 100 years in prison for crimes of sexual abuse after pleading guilty to multiple charges involving girls and women that he sexually abused under the premise of medical treatments. And this story has taken an even more tragic turn, Jim, as to what happened in the investigation. So give us a little background on Larry Nassar's prosecution and what has now surfaced from the Inspector General at the Department of Justice.
Sure. Well, you know, Dr. Nassar was being internally investigated by the USA Gymnastics operation, you know, part of the U.S. Olympic Committee. And they were the ones that started to turn over information initially to the FBI and eventually to other sources about all of these experimental therapies, as he was calling them, that were actually sexual offenses against mostly teenage gymnasts. As it turns out, this becomes a very important fact for the Inspector General report. Dr. Nasser had that position through Michigan State, where he was working with the Olympic athletes, but he also worked as the physician for a travel team of teenagers and a local high school. So he had access to an awful lot of victims. He was eventually prosecuted for numerous sexual offenses, as well as possession of child pornography. When the FBI raided his residence and got his laptop, there were 37,000 images of child sexuality on his computer. So it's really just a horrific guy. But the IG report is not focusing so much on all of the evil deeds of Dr. Nasser. It's focusing on how the FBI specifically handled the investigation when it came to their attention in 2015.
Now, the Inspector General's report really focused on an individual within the FBI, and this really gets kind of crazy.
It does. It's primarily circling around the FBI SAC, the special agent in charge. That's the head of the field office, in this case in Indianapolis, Indiana. And what happened was he was specifically in the mix for these conversations, which is a little bit unusual because typically you'd have regular agents as opposed to the supervisor. But the supervisor was advised by the U.S. Gymnastics that they had uncovered through an internal investigation credible complaints of sexual abuse of three different gymnasts. He took in that initial information, didn't really document anything at all. I mean, that's one of the major shortcomings here is the Indianapolis division of the FBI did almost nothing to document what they did by way of investigation. But supposedly, they did a telephonic interview of one of the gymnasts and had some questions about whether or not they had venue in Indianapolis as opposed to somewhere else like Michigan, and whether or not they had federal offenses. And they had legitimate legal questions that they brought to the U.S. attorney, and the U.S. attorney said, well, you should probably talk to the Lansing, Michigan field office. And I know all of this sounds terribly bureaucratic, but it becomes very important in the investigation because, as it turns out, the special agent in charge, Mr. Abbott, lied to the inspector general by saying he had, in fact, formally referred all of this information to the Lansing office in a timely fashion. He said there's a paper trail, but he couldn't find it. He said that he acted on this promptly and even went so far eventually as to talk to the media to essentially celebrate that the FBI moved efficiently and quickly when it came to handling these complaints and putting them to the right folks. Well, as it turns out, Indianapolis never did anything in terms of prosecution or doing anything to support a prosecution. And eventually, with no help from Indianapolis, other law enforcement got notified and built a case and stopped the abuse. But the key is FBI in Indianapolis sat for 8 months without doing anything to investigate or to promote the investigation of Dr. Nasser's crimes.
So the Inspector General's report is focused on the one supervising agent, and it gets even worse.
Well, it does, because when you start doing the math and looking at the chronology in this situation, what the Inspector General reported on was that 70 victims of Dr. Nasser were molested during that period that the Indianapolis supervisor buried the investigation. In other words, kids in high school, kids on the Olympic team, all of these victims didn't have to happen if the FBI had reported to local authorities, as they were obliged to do, that this doctor was involved in sexual offenses.
And is there any reason given in the Inspector General's report as to why the agent acted in this manner?
Well, there's a real critical part of the report that is certainly suggestive of what the motivations were here, and it's spectacularly damning. You know, Inspector General reports write things in kind of an antiseptic way, so this might be more my phrasing than theirs. But what they looked at was the fact that during that period of inactivity, that the special agent in charge for Indianapolis, this Mr. Abbott, met at a bar with the U.S. gymnastics leader who had brought this information to him. They commiserated about how the whole story of Dr. Nasser could become bad press for the U.S. Olympic Committee as well as for the FBI. And effectively, it sounds like there was kind of this wink and a nod to lowball the story or bury the story The motivation appears to be that this FBI supervisor wanted a job with the U.S. Olympic Committee. So he thought by helping bury the story of Nassar's behavior that it was going to ingratiate him and let him retire from the FBI and take a plush job with the U.S. Olympic Committee.
And this is in the Inspector General's report.
This is in the report. And not only is it in the report, but they talk about how Supervisor in Charge Abbott lied to them about seeking that job. He twice was interviewed and asked, did you not try to pursue a job with the U.S. Olympic Committee? He denied it. They found that he was lying to them.
Does he face any consequences?
He doesn't face any consequences. He is retired from the FBI. He got out in front of this thing landing. And the officials at the Department of Justice that looked into all this information have apparently sworn off any prosecution of him or any other FBI agents that contribute to the problem. We know that because they are in a position at the Inspector General to compel interviews, which you can't do unless prosecution is sworn off. So there's a damning report that's out there, a horrible commentary on some of the culture within the FBI, and there will be no criminal consequences for any of the people that did it.
And us taxpayers can continue to pay his pension.
Yeah, he'll do okay. He'll have a long pension, and it will not be affected by this.
Let's turn to another story, Jim, and that is the New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. This is from the New York Times. When investigators from the New York State Attorney General's office face Governor Andrew Cuomo for the first time today, they will do so with an abundance of testimony and evidence. Over the past 4 months, lawyers investigating sexual harassment claims against Mr. Cuomo have interviewed the women who have accused him, members of his security detail, and other witnesses. Jim, we've seen Governor Cuomo in action. What would we expect to have happen in this deposition?
Well, it really entirely depends on whether it's a full-fledged cross-examination or more of a check-the-box exercise. You know, if you go back to Hillary Clinton being interviewed about her server, it was pretty clearly a check-the-box exercise rather than an intense or vigorous cross-examination. If it is a cross-examination, and it'll be a while before we ever see this publicly, I think there's some obvious things that a good prosecutor would try to do. The first is to try to get him to concede some of the general dynamics or circumstances of the events. In other words, they have all these details from the alleged victims describing the time, the location, whether they were alone or how they became alone. You know, you'd want to get him to have to concede that they have that right, that they're accurate when they describe the circumstances in which he either said inappropriate things or touched them inappropriately or both. You also would probably want to get him to either speculate or at least or maybe concede that the women have no motivation to lie. In other words, that there's not some pre-existing problem between them that would spark some sort of false allegation. And if he gratuitously tries to say they're liars, that can backfire. Or if he concedes it, that they're not liars, that can obviously help the case against them as well. And I think for a guy of his ego, I think you probably want to try to dazzle him a little bit or surprise them a little bit with some facts or some information that shows a deeper investigation. In other words, if there are some victims who are out there that are not in the public eye, you know, maybe show him a text or an email thread from that. If you're fighting over whether or not he was with a particular woman on a particular night, you know, maybe they have GPS from his cell phone that they could confirm the location. So it's never a bad idea for a guy who's very self-confident to be kind of disrupted in the interview with some sort of information that he didn't see coming. And then I think the last thing I would add in, particularly in Cuomo's case, is I would explore really heavily any efforts he has made, probably indirect efforts, but efforts to obstruct. In other words, to suggest to these women, this is going to be really embarrassing, painful, don't do it. Any sort of interference with their reporting of his conduct, I think that would be a big one to spend some time on to get him to, you know, probably concede that he put some people in motion that were out there trying to get these women to walk away from the offense.
If he is less than truthful in the deposition, whether it's due to memory, whether it's due to arrogance of his ego and just not admitting things to himself, but let's say he's not truthful, what happens?
Well, it's a great question because, again, it really gets back to the integrity or the seriousness of the investigation. So it could be that you end up with a situation where they look at them and they say, well, we can disprove this part, maybe not, you know, ultimate sexual offenses or sexual conduct, but this aspect is material and is being false. And they can come out with something that says, we're not sure where we end up on the harassment, but we're sure he lied. That could be legally problematic in terms of like a false statement or obstruction prosecution. It could certainly be politically damaging as well. And again, I also think he's the type of guy that might have kind of the Clinton Paula Jones moment where he's too clever by a half, as they say, you know, dissembling what is, and well, what do you mean sex? Mm-hmm. And so he might get into that same kind of thicket that Bill Clinton found himself in, not just for flat out lying, but for fencing with his questioners and sounding a little too glib, a little too arrogant for his own good.
And what's next? What happens after the deposition?
Well, most investigations into conduct by somebody like Mr. Cuomo are going to build up and end with the questioning of him. So presumably this means they've fully interviewed victims, gathered up any sorts of evidence they can gather in terms of either cyber-based things like, you know, text messages, emails, interviewed people maybe on the periphery, like these people that might have intervened on Cuomo's behalf. So typically to get to the target or the defendant, that usually means you're getting near the end of the investigation. And so then we look back to the office of Letitia James at the Attorney General, and presumably she'll either issue a report with her findings or perhaps charge him, indict him with particular offenses or some combination of those two.
So let's say it is a little dicey in that deposition. Can he plead the Fifth without damaging his position?
The first part of that is absolute, that he has a Fifth Amendment privilege, at least as long as the offenses are within the statute of limitations. Now, there may be, I think, there are some of these allegations that are probably outside any applicable statute of limitations, so he really doesn't have the right to take five on those. What's interesting is in the political setting, as opposed to a private citizen, taking five can be politically devastating. So he might, you know, assert that privilege at certain junctures, and that's a pretty horrific moment for a civil litigant in general, but it's a particularly bad moment for a politician who's trying to say he didn't do anything wrong.
And what are the chances that the deposition is released to the public?
Again, we have to go back to Letitia James. I mean, she could decide to release all of this stuff as part of a comprehensive report. I suppose if she charges him with anything, she probably won't, because it's really part of the eventual evidence for a criminal trial, whether it's for sexual offenses or for false statements. So I don't think it's going to see daylight soon, but it could see daylight eventually, just depending on what the approach is that James wants to follow.
That deposition taking place today. Jim Trustee, IFRA Law, thank you so much. Jim, appreciate the perspectives.
Sure thing. Have a good weekend.
And you can follow Jim on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. We've got the 7 o'clock news coming up next with Heather Curtis. Then we are back with John Gizzi. Get the very latest from the White House, as he is the Newsmax White House correspondent. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer will join us. Gordon Chang will join us on a look at the very latest on the investigation into the origins of COVID-19. And KT McFarland coming up as well. Stay with us.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. America's reopening. Hear it here. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus station.